Good morning. Swifties on Morning Ireland. Resistance is futile. This is Taylor Swift's weekend. Sequins, sequins everywhere, including on our arts and media correspondent.
I don't know what's happening to me, Áine. I'm standing here since 7 o'clock this morning wearing sequins and a pink jacket. I said to somebody earlier, I feel like I'm on my way home from my Debs or something. This is Taylor Swift mania gone mad. I don't know what's going on. I need coffee, clearly.
What's going on is a full weekend in Dublin for the world's biggest superstar. And the Darcy was in a roadcaster down at the Aviva Stadium yesterday. Tay Tay fan Connor Pope outlined just how big a deal she is.
As a cultural moment, it's probably one of the biggest in the last 20, 30, 40 years and possibly ever. I mean, it's the first one...
Garth Brooks.
Oh, listen, she'd leave Garth Brooks in the Halfpenny Place. I mean, it's the first billion-dollar tour. She's the first billion-dollar pop star. She was the Time Woman of the Year, Time Person of the Year last year. She has completely redefined the music industry, and she has done it in a way that I think is just so hugely impressive. Because in times past, if you look back to the days of Elvis Presley, when he was effectively controlled by Colonel Parker, and then you look at the Beatles, and they lost control of all of their music, and all the way through history, the artists have been the ones who've been exploited to a degree. Now, they were super famous and they were super wealthy, but Taylor Swift has completely redefined it, because she lost the master tapes of her earlier recordings, and then she said, right, I'm not standing for that, and she went and re-recorded them all, and that's what the Taylor's version of all her albums are. And I think that's great, and I also think it's really impressive that she's made the $1 billion on the back of her art. So it's not like Mick Jagger is a very, very wealthy pop star, but an awful lot of his money would have come from investments and property and all these other things. Almost all of the money she's made from her songs. And I love the fact that she writes her own songs. I love the fact that the songs are incredibly complex, and also almost everything she writes is an earworm. So, for instance, she released the Tortured Poets Department, what, 6 weeks ago?
Yeah.
I practically know the words to about 8 or 10 of the songs now. Now, part of that is as a result of my family and my children are particular Swifties. And actually, I saw Dad coming down the street there a few minutes ago, and his T-shirt said, I'm a Swiftie by choice, .. My daughter's choice. And I kind of love that, because I love the fact that my children have made me appreciate Taylor Swift more than I would have.
Did they put the glitter on your cheeks as well?
100%. My daughter is sitting outside the road.
In fact, such is the ardour and energy of the Swifties that they might just cause the earth to move. Here's Eleanor Dunn from the Dublin Institute of Advanced Studies.
You are measuring on the Richter scale what level of earthquake the Taylor Swift concerts are going to create. Is that correct?
Yes.
Why?
Yes. So the idea kind of came about because last year in Seattle, there was a lot of kind of attention about how her fans had generated this earthquake. And then similarly, again, in Edinburgh, just recently, there was more reports that they'd generated another earthquake and it had been picked up 6 kilometres away. So this kind of led to the idea for my PhD, actually, to do this in Dublin, but on a quite a big scale. We're putting loads of instruments to measure ground vibrations around the Aviva Stadium. We're putting them quite close. So our closest one is about 30 metres away, and then we've got one that's like 10 kilometres away. So we're going to see how far the kind of shock waves generated from the concert radiate outwards of the Aviva Stadium.
Particular moments, I would imagine.
Yes, so there's definitely going to be songs which we can hopefully see that, oh, this song is the most popular. I mean, so for Edinburgh, Ready For It, Champagne Problems and Cruel Summer were the most popular.
So what's the hypothesis? Because if you're doing research, you need to have a hypothesis, as in you, what do you think's going to happen?
Yes, so we think that, you know, seismic activity is definitely going to be created. We think so. What's generated from a concert is different from what you might think of as a typical earthquake. So a typical earthquake is like a sudden, sharp release of energy, whereas a concert, you know, it's continuous. I mean, this is 3.5 hours, so it's not going to be like an earthquake as such. It's going to be more of a continuous seismic activity, and then some songs are going to be proven to be more popular and more energetic with more seismic activity.
And out talking to the fans that may cause such seismic activity, Sinead Neulachon.
I'm going as Ivy today. It's my favourite song.
You actually have Ivy on your costume.
I have Ivy, yeah, wrapped around an €8 dress from the charity shop. Really excited, going for the 3 nights.
Three nights? Tell us about your outfit.
Well, my outfit is the Midnight Elf. I got this dress in the charity shop for €8, and the sequences and the fringing was put on by my son. The boots I had, put some glitter on them, and happy days, I'm going to be shaking it all off.
I'm very excited. Like, my excitement is through the roof. It's just up there.
Your outfit is up there as well.
So my outfit is inspired by Taylor Swift's Red Tour. She wears the similar thing, like it's a ringmaster. It's very glittery. My outfit came from Philippines, so I had it delivered here in Dublin. Yeah, it took like 1 week to tailor my outfit.
To tailor your Taylor Swift outfit.
Tailor my Taylor Swift outfit. Great pun there.
Not only is she just a girl's girl, and she's here, and she's such a feminist, and she fights for what she loves. Her music is incredible. Like, the first song I ever learned on guitar was a Taylor Swift song. That's the reason I'm here. I've been a fan of her since I was 8 years old. I'm 22 now. So a long time.
What was the song, the first song you learned?
Her song, so it's from her very first album. Our song is a slam a screen door, sneaking out late, tapping on your window.
Woohoo! Go Angela!
Very cute. But if all of this is going above your head, eluding you, fret not, you are not alone. And luckily, D'Arcy Show producer Niamh Hassell was on hand with the cheat sheet to being a Swiftie.
So I've seen a number of people wearing red vests with the number 87 on it. Just explain that to me.
The number 87 refers to Travis Kelce, Ray. And Travis Kelce is the boyfriend and partner of Taylor Swift, and he plays for the Kansas Chiefs, who have just won the Super Bowl.
He has just appeared
on stage with her in Wembley, which was a massive
deal. Right.
And his brother Jason Kelce and his wife Kylie was in the crowd.
Aha. Yes. Now, your top is lovely, sequined, and sequined is the order of the day for a lot of people here. I'm looking around, there were two ladies dancing to the new Brass Kings. They were in sequins.
Yeah.
A lot of that. There's a lot of hats. Is there a different hat for different albums?
No, so the 22 hat is the most pivotal hat that you need to know about. It's the bowler hat, right?
Sorry.
It's given away to one lucky audience member a night, which is selected by Andrea, who is Taylor Swift's mom.
Aha, and she travels on the tour.
She travels on the tour on Taylor's private jet with her.
Now listen, if you're listening at home, there will be a quiz at the end, so pay attention. No, there won't be.
There might be, because even newsroom greats were getting giddy.
Do you know what I want to know? Travis Kelce going to turn up, her boyfriend, and pick her up like he did in London last weekend? Because that was a moment.
It was. Do you know what? Wouldn't it be great if we did it in a GA county jersey? That's what we'd love. Travis Kelce
yes,
wearing the old Dublin
the idea
jersey.
Now.
Tell you now, wouldn't that be fantastic? That'd be a moment, wouldn't it? I wonder, though, it is more rugby, I suppose, around here, but...
And here is Sarah trying in vain to bring a bit of balance to proceedings. She's talking to Alan Corr.
Of course, it's not the only thing that's going on this weekend, which is going to make for a lot of fun for anybody trying to get anywhere in Dublin this weekend. What else is happening?
Well, you've got lesser pop superstar Shania Twain in Malahide Castle. You've got the Longitude Festival in Marley Park. You've got the Great Saw Doctors in Fairview Park. You've got the Dublin Pride Parade, of course, and you've got those senior football championships, two of them, the quarterfinals happening in Croker as well. But I think the word on everyone's lips is going to be Taylor Swift. She really is the golden ticket this weekend, this crazy busy weekend in the capital.
I thought you were going to say Galway to beat Dublin in Croke Park, but there you go.
You're asking the wrong person for me.
And we will return to the phenomenon that is Tay-Tay later. But yesterday, the fallout from that US presidential debate. Not Joe Biden's day, that's for sure.
What I'm going to do is fix the tax system. For example, we have 1,000 trillionaires in America. Billionaires in America. And what's happening? They're in a situation where they, in fact, pay 8.2% in taxes. If they just paid 24% or 25%, either one of those numbers, they'd raise $500 million, billion dollars, I should say, in a 10-year period. We'd be able to wipe out his debt. We'd be able to help make sure that all those things we need to do, child care, elder care, making sure that we continue to strengthen our health care system, making sure that we're able to make every single solitary person eligible for what I've been able to do dealing with everything we have to do with. Look, if we finally beat Medicare.
Just one clip from that 90-minute debate. On Morning Ireland, global security reporter based in New York, Yvonne Murray, gave her verdict.
Well, look, I think it went very badly for President Joe Biden. This was his moment to show he had the energy, the vitality to lead the country for four more years, and he just did not deliver. It started badly. He walked stiffly onto the stage. He cleared his throat before he spoke, and then when he spoke, his voice was hoarse. And then you have this contrast of former President Trump. He strode onto the stage much more confidently. He spoke much more fluently. There was no handshake between the two men. The animosity between them was clearly palpable. And then as they tried to answer the questions, issues of concern for American voters, you know, price of essential items, migration, abortion, all of these things, Trump did manage to speak more confidently and therefore appear a little more presidential, is really what it comes down to. And I think Biden, who knew going into that debate that there were serious concerns about his age, failed to allay those concerns.
With Colm, Scott Lucas, Professor of US and International Politics at the Clinton Institute at UCD.
What did you make of it?
Pray for America today. Pray for all of us, because on one side we had a poor presentation by the current U.S. president, who looked frail, who was far from concise, and on the other side you had a convicted felon, a sex abuser, a fraudster, a man who pursued an attempted coup less than 4 years ago, who lied from start to finish about the critical issues facing America in the most important election probably since 1865.
Now, reports of a Democratic Party scrambling. Sticker twist. Do they dare find a last-minute replacement? Also with Colm, Greg Swenson of Republicans Overseas in the UK.
It does seem remarkable that somebody who didn't even concede that they lost the election last time round is a credible candidate for the Republican Party, but yet he's doing well in the polls. What would he welcome in terms of an opponent? A new, fresh Democrat or continuing with Biden? Or does he care at this point because the momentum would appear to be with him?
Yeah, I'm quite sure. I'm speculating, I should say, that President Trump really wants Biden to be the candidate. And I think the Democrats would be wise to pick someone else. And they should have done it 2 years ago and had an open nomination process. So I think, you know, they might pull him or talk him into it. And you're absolutely right. There's really no mechanism in place. The 25th Amendment would be very difficult. It's never been used, actually. It'd be very difficult to execute that. So perhaps the elder statesman will be having a heavy conversation with President Biden.
And on the News at One, a similar line of questioning from Cian McCormack to Julia Manchester, reporter at The Hill.
David Axelrod, a former aide to President Barack Obama, told CNN there are going to have to be discussions about whether Biden can continue. Is that a real prospect now?
So we've heard, you know, a speculation about that in the past, and Democrats have rushed that off, saying that's not, that's blown out of proportion, et cetera. You know, from what I've been hearing now, you know, I don't know if a lot of Democrats are calling it a prospect now, but the fact that it's even being mentioned among Democrats, and there's chatter about it now before the Democratic National Convention in August, I think that's very, very significant.
And can they go about making changes? How easily could that be done?
You know, it would be difficult. It would have to be done at the convention in Chicago. So, another person would have to be nominated. There are questions as to who that would be. It could be Vice President Kamala Harris, California Governor Gavin Newsom, Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer. I'm naming a lot of people who have been considered 2028 presidential hopefuls. But essentially, they would be nominated and delegates would have to decide at the convention. But that would be a very... it would be a mess, quite frankly, at this point in the campaign.
From the News at One, and as one of the world's most powerful countries, this election really does matter. Back to Colm with Scott Lucas.
Marine Le Pen's party has a very good chance of taking power in France. Donald Trump has a very good chance of taking power in the US now. On the international stage, things have changed a hell of a lot in 6 months, and many would argue not for the better.
I think Natasha nailed it when she said the future of democracy, including the US system, is at stake, because that's true in other countries as well. And I think what you're seeing here is that the prospect of hard right candidates or candidates who specialize in disinformation to the point of appeasing Russia, to the point of cutting off aid to Ukraine, you could have that in France and in the United States, where I think it's probably vital, given how dysfunctional the American system is, with regret, that we here in Ireland and we here in Europe need to make preparations now for our security, need to make preparations for our economic welfare and for the welfare of the countries across this continent, anticipating that the real challenges, the real threats to come, will be from a former ally in the United States.
Surely it cannot be that bad. We'll let Oliver tee up our final clip on this one.
Huge issues for the world, Ukraine, Gaza. But this is the way the debate ended. This is the international policy issue where these two men vying to be the leaders of the most powerful country and most powerful economy in the world right now. This is the topic they end upon.
But I took 2 cognitive tests. I took physical exams every year. And, you know, we knock on wood wherever we may have wood, that I'm in very good health. I just won 2 club championships, not even senior. 2 regular club championships. To do that, you have to be quite smart, and you have to be able to hit the ball a long way. And I do it. He doesn't do it. He can't hit a ball 50 yards. He challenged me to a golf match. He can't hit a ball 50 yards.
President Biden?
You can see he is 6'5" and only 235 pounds, or 235 pounds. Well, you said 6'4", 200. Well, anyway, that's what you're... Anyway, just take a look at what he says he is, and take a look at what he is. Look, I'd be happy to have a driving contest with him. I got my handicap, which when I was vice president, down to a 6. But by the way, I told you before, I'm happy to play golf if you carry your own bag.
Golf! That's what they chose to end on. Golf!
Back in a bit. Welcome back. On Tuesday, this sad news.
We just got a note in from Micheál O'Meara Hartig's family, and I'll read it to you. It says, with great sadness, the family of Micheál O'Meara Hartig announced that he passed away peacefully this morning, surrounded by his family in the Mater Hospital in Dublin.
He was 93. And on the news at 1, this tribute to a man and a voice that would be synonymous with so many Sundays.
Captain inside the 45, from out the wing, what a majestic point, the point of the game so far.
Micheál O'Meara Hartig was born in a family home in Dún Sheen, just outside Donegal, County Kerry, on August 20th, 1930. One of 8 children born to his mother, Katie Quinn, and his father, Teddy Moriarty. 18 years later, he began the final year of his teacher training at St Patrick's College of Education in Drumcondra in Dublin.
The big attraction, of course, of being in Pats was Croke Park, principally. And to nearly the first place we went, that was the Mecca. And I don't think we were a full week there when we saw the first All-Ireland final I ever saw. Mayo against Cavan in 1948.
In early March 1949, Micheál, along with 10 other students from the college, did an audition on a hurling game in Croke Park for Ready Erin. Kerryman had never seen a game of hurling before in his life, but he was the one selected. His first assignment was to provide an all-Irish commentary on the 1949 Railway Cup final on St Patrick's Day. He graduated from St Patrick's College a little later and also completed an arts degree from UCD. He taught economics, accountancy and Irish in both primary and secondary schools throughout Dublin until the 1980s, when he became a full-time broadcaster with RTE.
The ball thrown in by Patrick Kelly. Cork playing down towards the railway goal in the first half in the ball. Nobody got it into the hand yet. Picked up by Gerry O'Connor and the first test of Henry of the centre-back John Tennyson.
In 1970, he married Helena McDowell and together they had 8 children. His beautiful accent, his unique turn of phrase and ability to paint pictures with words captured the minds and hearts of his listeners, the people of Ireland and abroad.
Well, there's a streaker on the ground now. He must be a Kilkenny man because he's quite happy with the situation.
I'm sitting between two very privileged people, joint owners of Druids Jono, Patsy Boddington Dua, and His Royal Highness Prince Edward. I think, Prince, your reaction to that great run by the favourite.
Well, it was great. No, it was great. And it was well worth coming here and to see that.
High in the air, not a confident kick by any means. Off the upright blitz.
His journey in broadcasting earned him a place in the Guinness Book of Records for having the longest career as a live match commentator. Micheál was a special man with a special broadcasting talent. Today, Micheál Meirhertig died, but the magic of his voice and the memories he gave us will mean in our minds he will live forever.
Once an All-Ireland final is over, especially the last one of the year, it's like closing in something, but you're already looking forward to the resurrection. And like the flowers that grow after the flowers dying with the frost of the winter, the new ones will come if you're lucky enough to be around for them.
And so many tributes were paid to a commentator who had made the job his own. With Cian, Kerry footballer Pat Spillane.
He was the voice of Gaelic games. He brought excitement to the worst of games. He brought atmosphere to the worst of games. He painted a picture of games that you felt you were at the game, but you weren't. Can I just quote you something that I thought I saw on X, and it was from a former colleague of mine in the Sunday World, Roy Curtis, and I thought, this is just beautiful, and this sums up Micheál Meirhertig. And these are Roy's words. His symphonic West Kerry lilt was the soundtrack of the long days. His voice was a sonic river dance, a traditional, vibrant, soaring, musical, heart-lifting celebration of Irishness. His words danced, the Carran tool of commentators.
Oh, what an evocative line. And we also had this from former Armagh player and GAA president Jarlath Burns.
My father used to sit in the car to listen to the rest of Micheál Meirhertig's commentary on the radio rather than go in and actually watch it on the television. And we used to be looking out the window at him and thinking, oh my God. And that is the epitome of what Micheál Meirhertig could do. Pat, you're 100% right. He could actually create almost a better image of the game than the images themselves that you were watching, which is a remarkable tribute to somebody who was on the radio.
And on Liveline, colleagues, friends and fans phoned in to remember a man whose career had spanned six decades, all led by Katie Hannon, herself a proud Kerry woman.
If ever there was a national treasure, I think Micheál Meirhertig definitely qualifies, and certainly anyone that came from Kerry of my vintage, he was the sound of our childhood summers. What a loss. What a great, great presence.
And so many callers to Liveline lined up to praise Micheál Meirhertig. First up, his longtime producer, Ian Corr.
He was a phenomenon in the sense that he never allowed the white lines to limit his vision of what was going on in front of him. And he actually would have, if he happened to be in a ground where you could see maybe an animal in a field or something like that, he would, remember Richie Bennis, I think he had to point a free to win the match for Limerick, and Micheál commented about the fact that there was a cow in the next field who was quite indifferent to what was happening on the pitch, and that was Micheál's gift.
And for former player Anna Geary, her first commentating gig was alongside the great man. No pressure.
Growing up in my house, the GA was always on and the radio was always on. And Micheál Meirhertig for me was the voice of the GA. So to have ever had an opportunity to work with him was such a privilege. It was all the way back in 2010. And we had lost to Galway in the All-Ireland semi-final at the Camogie. And I suppose the only silver lining of that was I got the chance then to co-commentate on Radio 1 with the great Micheál Meirhertig. Like, I can remember even being in the crow's nest, you know, in the lead up to the game, and, you know, he had his system, and I was just in awe, because I suppose when you're listening to him on the other side, you know, when you're listening on the radio in your kitchen, and he has, like, you know, he has the knowledge, and he's so sharp, and he'll know whatever sub is coming on, and he'll have the information about them, and then he'll be able to jump back to the match, and then he'll have a story. And I suppose people will always talk about Michal with such love, but I think it was his ability to bring matches to life, and his wit, like, obviously the level of professionalism he had, but the lines that he would just throw in the middle of a match and in the middle of a commentary. And I remember my late dad always saying one of the ones that he loved was when Joe Rabbit and Pat Fox were playing Croke Park against each other when Galway and Tip were playing, and when he said about, you know, I've never seen a rabbit chase a fox around Croke Park, I've seen it all. He just, you know, I suppose he brought games to life, and he had just an ability to inject colour. And, you know, I suppose really it's wonderful that we can celebrate him today, but it's just such a sad day as well for the GA world because, you know, he was one of the very, very best.
And there were so many callers who paid tribute to his knowledge of the game and his sense of mischief. Phoning into Katie, former president Mary McAleese.
In the days to come, you'll hear many, many, many tributes to Michal. And you know what? No matter what language they're couched in, we'll never be able to do justice to that genius of the Gael. His likes, as they say, will never be seen again. Weren't we lucky? Weren't we the luckiest country ever to have him? He was just an endless miracle of goodness and genius. And to hear his voice, I mean, you'd only be two words in and you'd know it was Michal.
Yeah.
And we always will know it's Michal.
From Liveline, celebrating the life of the late Michal Amara Hurtig, who died on Tuesday at the age of 93. And on the same day, more sad news, former Northern editor Tommy Gorman, who died at the age of 68. On Drive Time, former Taoiseach Bertie Ahern paid tribute to the journalist.
He was respected by loyalists, unionists, republicans, nationalists. He took a huge interest in it. And he just didn't report on things. Mm-hmm. If Tommy saw a solution, and he would be tic-tacking with everybody about what he thought we should be doing and advising us, and he was, you know, on top of everything and right through all the talks. He was very close, and he knew all sides. He knew the British delegation, knew the Irish delegation, and my last occasion was with him. We did a thing just two weeks ago tonight, with George Mitchell was over for a holiday, with a family holiday, and Gerry Adams and Reg MP, George and myself were with Tommy up in the Ambassadors. He was in great form. He wrote a good article on that event, and he seemed in good form. So it's just so sad.
And Morning Ireland played us this clip from an interview Tommy Gorman did on The Late Late Show when he was retiring in 2021.
The biggest achievement of the last 20, 30 years in this country is that we stop the killing. When anger is in flood, people do awful things to each other. And there's not a day in Northern Ireland when you'd be working when you wouldn't come across somebody who has the scars of that time. And Hume's vision won out. Live and let live. Try and get on together. But if we're to be any way true to what everyone has bought into in the peace process, we just have to make sure that as we're planning this debate, that we don't create a generation or a group of politically homeless people. And that could be unionists. You can't have any sort of a useful Ireland, shared island, if you have up to 1 million people feeling they've been left behind. Because I think this country, north and south, is at its best when it's tolerant. Mm. You look at the good things that have happened, Ryan, you know, relation to gay rights, in relation to minorities, in relation to how we've looked to see some of the flaws in our society in the past. You look at how ugly we were during the Celtic Tiger. Mm. And I think we have to bear those things in mind when we're having the inevitable debate.
The unmistakable voice of Tommy Gorman, who died this week at the age of 68. Back in a bit. Welcome back. There was a lot of music on the radio this week, Tay-Tay obviously everywhere, but there was more. Monday had Crowded House with the Darcy, and it was a love-in of the best possible kind. They had nothing to prove, and really were just up for the crack.
We were coming down in the car, myself and my son, and we listened to all the versions of Don't Dream It's Over.
Oh, did you fall asleep?
No. There's an Italian guy who does it in Italian.
Oh, my God. Have you watched the video for that?
No, it's good, isn't it?
You better watch it. It's Angelina Jolie's debut performance as an actor.
Right.
I'd advise anybody to go and have a look. I didn't know about any of this at the time, and I was just delighted that somebody in Italy wanted to sing one of my songs.
Because they don't need permission, do they, Neil?
Well, they did in this case, but
did they? Right.
Yeah, no, I was a fool, actually, because the song became a huge hit, and it's much more well-known in Italy than our version. Antonio Venditti is his name.
Yeah, that's his name,
And he changed the lyrics, and I didn't really care, because I thought, I don't know what he's singing. But I would never do that now. And he was singing something like, after we make love, I smoke a cigarette. And an appalling travesty, really.
Yes. Don't dream it's over.
Don't dream it's over, baby.
I've never thought about it.
I'm coming back. Yeah. Rest.
It wasn't our favourite. It wasn't our favourite version.
It's actually great, and it's got a sax solo. In a way, I do like it.
Because
I love them all, really. You know, you can't choose who your children sleep with. That's the way I see it.
So you can't choose who cover your songs.
No. Yeah. And the songs just go on.
Your kids' lovers. Interesting analogy. But among all of the cover versions, this might stand out.
Although if you were choosing, you'd probably choose U2, I would imagine.
That's true.
I didn't have to choose them because they chose it.
Yes,
chose it, which was lovely, and that was a nice moment. It was, and we managed to interact a little bit in time for their last show at the Sphere, and I sent them a version of the song, which I'd had tucked away for a special occasion. And I thought, I'll just send it to them. You never know. Maybe they'll pop a vocal on it or something. As it turned out, they used it on stage. It was lovely. Yeah. And so we were singing together.
At the Sphere in Las Vegas. Will you give us a little bit of that now? You don't have to play the whole song. Just give us a little bit.
Give him the bass intro. That'll probably do it. It goes a bit like this.
Like a fretless.
No, well, did I?
Oh, we can play it. We can play it for you.
Yeah, it's for all the Sligo residents.
You need to play without a capo. No.
Oh, okay, fine. Cool. Come on, Nick, you fancy bass line.
Here we go.
There is freedom within. There is freedom without. Try to catch the deluge in a paper cup.
Crowded House sounding very mellow and chilled. In stark contrast to the Police, here's drummer Stuart Copeland on Arena.
The Police was like a Prada suit made out of razor blades. Very cool, but not comfortable. It was not a cozy band. We now, after, on the reunion tour, we went through band therapy and we figured out the cause of our differences. And they're all very respectable reasons for this. No ego, no satanic evil lurking. It was for very honest reasons. We rubbed each other up the wrong way. We make music for different reasons. We listen to different kinds of music. We make music by different means and for a different purpose. And when we were young and codependent, that was all good and it was inspiring. Then as we went through, five albums, those conflicts became more and more difficult. And now Old Stingo, who at first was loved it. We like his song. Oh, wow, cool. You want to completely mess up the rhythm? Sure, fine. Later on, having written a hit or two or three or four or five or six, he started to get the strange notion that he's pretty good at writing hit songs. And so it became more and more difficult for him to compromise. I mean, because he didn't just think of a song. He thought of the whole arrangement and everything, which he would bring in and then have to put up with the other two guys in the band who also had creative ideas. And he was actually very loyal. That's one of his main characteristics. He's a very loyal guy. He still has the same crew around him today that he's had for half a century. So he stuck it out and put up with us and put up with those compromises until he couldn't stand it anymore.
Ooh, a time to go your separate ways. Now, Stuart Copeland is coming to Galway for the Arts Festival to play the music of the Police with an orchestra conducted by Galway's own Emer Noon.
These songs everybody knows, which is the good part. There is a real power in a song that is known, much more emotional impact in Roxanne or Every Breath You Take than in a new song. So what you can expect is songs that you know, but they have been slightly lobotomized or deranged.
I don't know if you can be slightly lobotomized, but fair enough.
Yeah, just a little incision there. No, the reason that they were deranged was for a film that I made, comprised of my Super 8 footage that turned into a movie and required a score. So I got police music, carved it all up. And once the scalpel was out, the orgy began, taking Andy's guitar solo from here and putting it with that bass line from over there, and generally disassembling and reassembling in bizarre forms this familiar music.
And Kay asked Copeland about how his own upbringing had influenced their style.
That distinct reggae rhythm that some of the songs like Roxanne and Can't Stand Losing You have, did that come from you? Because you had this very exotic youth. You were brought up in the Middle East, in the Lebanon. So you were open to world music, for example.
Well, what has been called reggae was actually more accurately could be described as Arabic rhythm, which shares a couple of fundamental rhythmic features of reggae, including the emphasis on the third beat of the bar. You know, rock music is 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, da-da-do-da. They call it the backbeat. Da-do-da-da-do-da-da-do. Well, reggae lands on the third, and Arabic music also lands on the third beat of the bar. Da-da-da-boom. Da-da-1, 2, 3, 4, 2, 3. And the absence of 1, 2, 3, 4. Void, 2, 3, 4. And so this music, those rhythms were in my DNA and was kind of my secret sauce when it came to the confluence of punk and reggae.
Stuart Copeland with Kay on Arena. Now, how to get from there to industrial action at Aer Lingus? Secret sauce to swig as you hope your flight isn't cancelled? No, we won't bother. Your patience might just snap. Because if you had been hoping the Aer Lingus saga might come to a swift end, it's not looking likely. On Tuesday, the Labour Court met with both sides separately, but then said it would not be intervening right now. No point. Maybe in July. On Thursday, a wee ray of hope. Talks between IALPA and Aer Lingus. But it came to naught. On Wednesday, Clare got this assessment from Kevin Byrne, former Air Corps Lieutenant Colonel.
It is going to get worse before it gets better. And unfortunately, in the short term, certainly in the next 7 days, I fear for those who want to go on holidays on Saturday and Sunday.
Right. You think that this is going to, well, I suppose it's a pessimistic note to leave it on, that you feel it's going to get worse before it gets better.
Yes.
When you say Sunday, do you mean that there will be after effects felt from the strike,
yes,
which will run into Sunday, possibly into Monday?
Yeah, the airline now knows there's not going to be any flying of any shape between, 5 o'clock and 1 o'clock on Saturday. But how do you get back up? How do you replace those? Do you put those people onto other aircraft? And what effects does it have on people who will not, for example, fly after hours? They won't take calls. They won't have the flexibility that both Brian and Simon have alluded to earlier. In a roster system, and I've written rosters myself, the one thing you absolutely have to have in aviation is flexibility, because something will go wrong somewhere. Someone will be sick, some aircraft will break down, something will happen that it won't go to schedule. 97% of commercial aviation runs actually on time and without any problem. It's the 3% that have to be sorted out and can be sorted out, but they can't be done easily if people won't actually add to the flexibility that you need on their rosters. And if that's a work to rule, if that's what it means, it'll be fixed and it'll get worse and worse and worse as time goes on, sadly. Kevin,
however, yesterday evening, a fresh invitation from the Labour Court to both sides to attend a meeting on Monday. Aer Lingus said they would attend. Joining Cormac on Drive Time, Mark Tai of IALPA.
The invitation from the Labour Court to attend on Monday. Will you go?
Well, we're actually, we've just received that ourselves, Cormac, just recently, as you said. And we are discussing it at the moment. Obviously, yesterday evening, we were telling you all that we were considering an escalation to our actions in view of the company's actions. And the company have withdrawn a small element of their escalation in the banning pilots from their lounges. That has been rescinded. And now we see, as you said, an invitation from the Labour Court to attend on Monday. Mm-hmm. We're discussing all that. We're cognizant of it. we acknowledge the Labour Court's expertise and we will have an answer in due course. We have to have formal meetings to discuss that here.
Is it possible that you wouldn't go?
It's possible, but I would say, in fairness, it is unlikely. By the way, we do welcome the Labour Court's invitation. We have processes which we have to abide by. We hope that the Labour Court has seen now the seriousness of the situation and the reasonableness of a cumulative inflationary pay claim that is just to maintain pay in a profitable company.
What do you think will be different if and when you attend on Monday?
Well, I've actually just touched on that there. I think at this point in time, people understand, it's been all across the media for quite some time now, that we're not looking for more money. We're looking to protect our income. And we think everybody should certainly have that. And I hear what the Taoiseach has said and previously on Taoiseach. And in a sense, I welcome it. I don't believe anybody in the Oireachtas, whether in government or in a seat, would say to a voting person in this country that they don't have an expectation to have their income protected.
That's your interpretation of your pay claim, and Aer Lingus sees that differently, obviously.
From Drive Time yesterday, and IALPA subsequently confirmed that they would be attending that meeting on Monday. Well, we did promise a return to Taylor Swift, and with everything that is going on right now, if anyone can reach across the Great Divide, it might be her. On Morning Ireland, Evelyn O'Rourke learned the value of the friendship bracelet.
So what this is, you get your little crafting set and you dig out all your beads and you make your own kind of version of a little bracelet. And the idea then is when you come to your Taylor Swift gig, right, you trade your friendship bracelet. Now, it sounds lovely, but some people are a little bit competitive. I met one young man this morning who said to me he's not just going to swap any old random bracelet, is what he said to me. He's very picky about the ones he's going to trade with. But I'm looking at all these teenagers lined up and they're sitting here with their kits in the sunshine making their bracelets, chatting away to each other, swapping names and stories about Taylor Swift. It's quite remarkable, really, this community that Taylor Swift has built around her. Now, we know, of course, there was such huge...
Aw, Evelyn turning all Swifty. However, with Oliver earlier in the week, we had a slightly more critical look at the world's biggest superstar. This from journalist Amy O'Connor.
Are you a Swiftie, for
some? I'm not a Swiftie, and I heard you call me a Swiftie earlier, No, I'm not a Swiftie. I'm kind of more Swiftie curious.
Swiftie curious, she says. But when it came to Taylor Swift, she had a theory.
You've come up with this whole reality show.
Yeah, well, I think that there is an element of reality show-ness to Taylor Swift, right? Because she's constantly in feuds with other celebrities. She,
Very small things.
Over very small, minor things. Yeah. Minor slights a lot of the time. Mm. But, she gets into feuds. She slags her exes. She dishes the dirt on her relationships. And I think, you can say she's a brilliant songwriter, but I think part of the appeal is every time an album comes out, diving in, figuring out what song's about who, deciphering the lyrics and stuff. And I think that it kind of just reminds me of Love Island or something, yeah. Just in terms of how people kind of voraciously consume it and, kind of take on her enemies or her exes and stuff. It's kind of interesting.
And central to all good reality TV, fighting, name-calling, public spats, taking sides, in short, feuds. And there have been many.
Take, for instance, her most recent album. She's got a song on there called Thank You, Amy. Amy spelled A-I-M-E-E. Okay. And she's got the K and the I and the M capitalised. And that is about Kim Kardashian. So she all these, she just drops all these little nuggets and kind of Easter eggs, I suppose. Coded abuse, exactly. And if you know, you know.
Take it that we don't know. Tell us more.
She wrote Bad Blood. That's about, allegedly about Katy Perry, who she was in a years-long feud with.
Why were they fighting?
They were friends. And then I believe that Katy Perry poached some of her backup dancers and made...
like
I
think, we said, very
they,
minor
exactly,
thing.
Exactly. I think they went on tour there and then it was it was war. Mm. Yeah.
Now, to keep the kind of reality show plotline going with the Katy Perry story... They make up.
Yes.
And she appears in one of her videos.
In You Need to Calm Down, which is not one of her high points, I wouldn't say, musically.
I don't think so.
No, it wouldn't be for me now. But yeah, they make up. They were both probably at a slightly lower ebb at that point. And I think they knew this will generate a load of positive headlines and coverage. So let's appear in the music video for both of them. So.
Next up, Nicki Minaj.
I mean, I don't know if people remember, but this would be in about 2014-15. Yeah. And it was when the MTV VMA Awards were announced. I mean, this is the VMAs. We're not talking about the Oscars or anything here. But Nicki Minaj's video for Anaconda wasn't included in the shortlist for Video of the Year. And she went on Twitter to kind of complain about it because, in fairness, that year, Anaconda was probably one of the most viral videos. It definitely was like...
talked about.
One of the most talked about, definitely kind of a pop culture moment. And it wasn't included. And Nicki Minaj said, you know, if my video had had perhaps like skinny bodies, maybe I would have been in the lineup. And Taylor Swift perceived that as a dig at her because her video for Bad Blood was in the lineup. And Taylor Swift replied to her and was like, how do you know that one of the men did not take your space? This is not like you not to support other women. And it kind of blew up into this big thing. But actually people were saying to Taylor, like, you've kind of missed the point here. You know, Nicki Minaj's broader point was that black female artists maybe don't get the same kudos or acclaim as their white counterparts. So then Taylor Swift had to obviously apologise. And then lo and behold, a few months later at the VMAs, they performed together. So it was kind of amazing damage control.
That seems like quite a lot of scraps.
There's a lot of fears. I mean, like she's said before, it's not real if someone appears to never have any issues with anyone. I have my friends, I have enemies. And like, a lot of people don't have enemies. So that's quite, you know what I mean? It's quite a strong statement to make, I have my enemies. But she does. I mean, like, we won't go through them all, obviously, but like Kanye West, Kim Kardashian, that was obviously a huge one.
A one.
That was a big one.
Barack
but even
Obama, it got involved.
Barack Obama called Kanye West an ass after he, or jackass. But even people, people like, you know, she's had beef with Calvin Harris, who was one of her exes. Mm-hmm. It was all about who wrote This Is What You Came For. Jake Gyllenhaal, of course, he's the subject of All Too Well, one of her exes. So
I'm with Taylor on that one.
But texters in, not having it.
Until women are financially equal to men, there can't be proper equality. Here we have a woman who's financially conquered the world and is a role model for little girls and women to do the same. This is glib, I like her, but let's reframe the conversation around how Taylor Swift is breaking the financial mould for women, and let's ease off on the nose-holding during this piece, which is a response to various texts and so on.
Right, well...
I mean, she's done great things for women, but, you know, for one woman...
Well, this is it. I mean, ultimately, a lot of it's quite self-serving, yeah.
I'm merely Swiftie adjacent, but I don't understand all the hating here this morning. Don't bother fighting the Taylor Swift phenomenon, folks. Get on board and enjoy, says Joan in Dublin 7. It's good advice.
It's good advice. And listen, I'm not on board. It's just that there is, I think you were saying earlier, there is just a little sting in the tail with Taylor Swift, you know. So I think you can enjoy her music and, like, in fairness, the joy that she brings to mums, kids, everyone, it's kind of amazing. So I won't begrudge people their fun over the weekend, but
it's pop tunes. I know she wants to be taken seriously in some of her things, but she's really good at singing live.
She's really good at singing live. She puts on a good show, and they're undeniable bangers. So, you know, in fairness,
undeniable bangers.
Yeah.
That they are. Embrace it. You cannot escape it. And that is it from this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Don't tune in.